In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com. Look around, what do you see? Cars. Lots of them. And guess what? They're probably on Auto Trader. Whether you're into timeless classics or the latest trends, did somebody say solar-powered, eco-friendly, vegan, leather-wrapped, aromatherapy-scented, disco ball-equipped, self-driving car? If you see it on the road, you can likely find it on Auto Trader. Big cars, small cars, blue cars, new cars, used cars, electric cars, and one day, maybe even flying cars. With millions of options to choose from, buying a car becomes a whole lot easier. See it, find it, Auto Trader.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryan over there. There's Jerry out there, our ethereal ephemeral producer. And this is Stuff You Should Know, which, for this edition, I feel like we should be playing like harpsichord or something like that in the background when we start. You want to do that?
Should we gussy it up a little?
Yeah, Jerry knows what she knows her way around an old harpsichord, so maybe she can do that for us.
I wonder if we have a message break stinger that's harpsichord.
Oh, that's a great question. Because we've been getting, I mean, we've gotten great ones all along, but sometimes they're just showing up. I'm like, where did this come from? I don't even recognize this one. It's great stuff.
Yeah, and to, you know, for those of you that don't know, those are made by listeners.
Yeah, submitted out of the goodness of their hearts.
Yep,
for
always happen.
Yep, to say, here you go, guys, I hope you enjoy it. You can use it all you want. It's very sweet of
it
everybody.
Is.
So we're talking about the printing press, and we're talking about the invention of the printing press, and the printing press itself is basically synonymous with a man named Johann Gutenberg. Johannes? How would you, God, right out of the gate, man. I'm going with Johann Gutenberg, or as the rest of us in the world call him, Gutenberg.
Sure. Let's call him Steve Gutenberg.
Gutbuck. Okay?
Okay.
So Gutenberg is traditionally credited with inventing the printing press. And for all intents and purposes, he did invent the printing press. But as our friend Ed Grabanowski goes to great pains to point out, he did not invent it out of whole cloth, as apparently some people believe, that it was just a pile of lumber and an idea for him that he put together. Like every inventor who ever invented anything, he built on different concepts that had been worked out over centuries. The thing is like, that's not to detract from his accomplishment or anything like that. Like, what he did literally changed the world, as we'll see, in some amazing ways. But he helped provide the first information age and got really kind of screwed over in the bargain.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a familiar story at this point, right?
Sadly, yes, man. And I'm kind of sick of that. I wish.
Of which
the world...
one? Of stealing, of building on others, or of...
Oh, no, no, no.
Dying a pauper.
Yeah, the second one. No, I understand building on the work of others. That's the other thing, too, is I don't think Gutenberg ever said, like, no, I invented all of this without any help. We don't have any indication he was like that at all. It just kind of got hung on him over the years by sixth graders.
We built on the work of Adam Curry.
We did.
Right?
He's still at it. Did you know that?
He's still podcasting?
I'm almost 1,000,000% sure, which is really sure.
And did he really have the first one?
I don't know if he had the first, but he's credited with having the first.
Very interesting.
He's definitely still active on social media, for sure.
So, for the printing press, if we jump back in the old Wayback Machine, mm-hmm. and we breeze past Adam Curry there. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Adam. Oh, look at his hair just waving that
very
breeze.
Very nice. We would go back and see people carving up these things into wood, and then they would sort of like a stamp you would get for a kid these days. Or if you go to a stamp shop and you want to get a stamp with your address or whatever.
For an adult?
Yeah. Like we got a stamp made – Emily got a stamp made of our house when we finally finished renovating our house.
Cute.
Which we've never used.
Our friend, so that you haven't used, so is it a picture of your house?
Yeah, it's like, okay, it looks like a little woodcut, but it's not like we send people letters and stamp that or anything.
Man, I got to tell
you.
We
just sort of have one.
I would like to see that on a Christmas card envelope, you know?
You know what she did give me, and boy, I'm going to use it one day, is, you know how they would melt wax and seal the envelope with a little stamp?
Yes.
She got me one of those little kits for Christmas a couple years
ago. Very nice. And you still haven't used it?
No. You know what? I'm going to write you a letter on some vellum.
Thank you.
I'm going to stamp my house on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to wax seal it and then put on some red lipstick.
Uh-huh, and then tinkle on the whole thing.
Give it a kiss and then pee on it.
we have a stamp too, but it has our address stamped on. Our friends Laurel and Braden gave it to us.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Right, and we have used that one before, but I want to see this stamp. This whole Christmas card with tinkle on it and vellum and wax, I can't wait to see it.
All right. It's going to happen.
Okay.
So a woodcut, and a long way of saying it, looks sort of like one of these stamps. It's cut out of a wood block, and then you take paper or vellum or something, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to print it on, mm-hmm. rub it down with some ink, and then press it down. And they had a thing back in the day in Europe in the 1400s called block books.
Right.
That were made from these woodcuts. They were, you know, 10 to 25, 30 pages long. Mm-hmm. And they kind of look like comic books if you look them up. They have a little bit of artwork, a little bit of text.
Yeah, medieval comic books.
Yeah, it's like comic books without any of the fun because they had some sort of moral message attached to it usually.
Right. It was like a Jack Schick tract or something.
But they were a big deal in Europe in the 1400s, and they thought that they invented something. But, of course, the Chinese were like, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing this stuff for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and I think as far back as 868 CE, which is a while ago, more than 1,000 years, about 1,100 plus, the Diamond Sutra, which was a Buddhist text, was the first known printed book. And they printed it like you just described, where each page was a wood carving. In negative, Chuck, in negative.
Yeah.
Because if you made it in the positive, when you put the paper on it with the ink, it would be in reverse when you looked at it on the page. So you had to carve each page like that in negative. So it was a really difficult process, but it worked. It was useful. It was a lot easier once you got those blocks carved for a page than it was to transcribe entire books and texts by hand, which is what they'd done up to that point and still continued to do for a very long time.
Yeah. So when I saw the Diamond Sutra, just obviously the word sutra stood out to me because of the Kama Sutra.
Sure.
And I realized I didn't even know what that word meant. And this just, it's a collection of observations, basically.
You said, oh, it means cookbook.
Well, it could be. It's a collection of observations in a book or a pamphlet. And I think we really missed a diamond opportunity for our book title. By not calling it like the Stuff You Should Know Sutra.
Yeah. Well, hey, if this one goes even passingly well or sells passingly well, we'll probably have a second chance.
You can pre-order that thing, by the way.
The Stuff You Should Know Sutra?
No. Boy, you could pre-order that one.
Right.
I'm getting limber as we speak to try and get that one done.
Right. Yeah, you can pre-order our book, An Incomplete Compendium of Mostly Interesting Stuff.
Sutra.
Things.
It should have just had comma. Kama Sutra. Get it?
Right. Yep. I like that.
So that was one in 868 CE, like you said. Then in 971 BCE, there was another one called, did you mention that one, the Tripitaka?
Not yet.
That was another Buddhist text.
That was CE.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
So they got it wrong here?
Yeah.
All right.
So the whole thing starts about 1,100 years ago.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the one that had, I think, 130,000 wood block carvings.
Yeah. That's insane. That means not only that somebody carved that, but somebody kept that like at their house.
Yeah.
Imagine living around 130,000 wood block carvings and you would be like, I need to reprint page 832. And then having to go find the wood block carving for page 832 and just... It just sounds like a nightmare. I'd be like, I don't care about reading or literacy or moving humanity forward at this point.
Maybe it was the house. Mm-hmm.
You just blew my mind right out of the top of my head.
So there was some more experimentation going on after this in China and Korea. And they were using like little wood or ceramic or metal blocks to make individual characters for the first time. And this was a big kind of push forward toward what we all know as what would eventually be the Gutenberg press, is individual letters, or in their case, characters, instead of just doing each page as a separate woodcut.
Yeah, what's awesome is there's a commoner in China named Bi Sheng, who is thought to have come up with movable type, where rather than, you know, carving a woodblock for each page, you have letters, individual letters carved out, and you can arrange them just so any way you want. And then once you print that page, you can arrange them in a different way to print the next page. And that is a huge innovation for sure. And again, note that this guy came up with this in about 1041 CE, so a good 400 years before Gutenberg was working.
Why does Ed keep saying BCE?
I don't know. I think he really likes the sound of it.
All right. Fair enough.
It's definitely CE, though.
No, I'm not doubting that. I'm just...
I was thinking, too. I was like, gosh, what if he was right? What if all this had started a good 1,000 years earlier?
Yeah.
Like, how much further along would we be right now?
As a world, as humanity?
Yeah. If this had happened 3,000 years ago rather than 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, because here's the little spoiler. Printing books is a big deal.
Yeah.
Like some say that religion and democracy and, I mean, just sort of the advancement of humanity was key to advancing all those things.
Mm-hmm. You know who says that?
Us.
People who are right.
Us.
Yeah. I definitely am on board with that. Cause, yeah, the best way you can put it, it was the first information age that got launched by Gutenberg, by Gutbuck.
So
I keep saying that because that's Steve Gutenberg's handle on Twitter.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
Steve Gutbuck.
Is it really?
Mm-hmm. He is the nicest guy, too.
Do you follow him?
I haven't checked in on his feed for a very long time, but years back, he used to be like all up in our feed, and he was just so nice. Happy Friday, everybody kind of stuff, like every Friday.
Uh-huh.
Just a super nice guy. So I'm assuming nothing's gone horribly wrong with him and that he's still just as nice as he was a few years ago.
Well, I highly recommend, you know, I've always promoted the great, great Starz TV show Party Down, one of my favorite shows of all time.
Oh, yeah.
And Goots has a great, great, great episode. And it seems like that's who he is. And he's a super nice guy in that episode because he you know, it's about a catering company. There were a bunch of like writers and actors and stuff doing catering work.
Mm-hmm.
And he hires them to come over to his house for his birthday. They're there at the house when he pulls in and he's like, oh man, we ended up having a surprise party for me and I forgot. So he's just like, why don't you guys just come in and we'll be the party.
Right.
But you really get the idea that that's who Goots is as a person.
You know, what's great is you've definitely, definitely told that story before on the podcast, which means like we've gotten to this point where we're amassing, like we're building a standalone universe where like when Steve Gutenberg appears, this story pops up as well around him. You know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, I knew I told it. I couldn't remember when though. When would he have come up?
I don't remember, but I'm sure we talked also about what a great guy he is on Twitter and all sorts of stuff. Like we have a character, like a simulacrum of Steve Gutenberg that lives in our podcast universe. And he's very less multifaceted than I'm sure he is in real life. But in our universe, it's nice guy on Twitter, had a great episode of Party Down. That's all you need to know about Steve Gutenberg.
I know. We haven't even gotten into Police Academy. Do we do a show on Police Academy? So that probably would have made sense.
I don't think we have. If we have, I must have been blacked out or something.
All right, so printing press is advancing forward. Go to Korea in 1234, and you're going to find a man named Cho Yun-hui, who was commissioned to do some more Buddhist texts. A lot of this was Buddhist texts.
Well, yeah, if you'll notice, religious texts help push this whole thing forward from different religions even.
Yeah, like that Bible that Gutenberg would make.
Don't spoil.
Sorry. So this one was really, really long, and he was using this movable print that had already been around. But this time he was making these letters for metal, kind of using what the technique they did for coin minting, which had been going on for a while, set them in a frame, lined them all up, coated them with ink, and pressed them.
Yeah.
And if you think, hey, that sounds like a printing press, you would be exactly right.
You're right, fella. For sure. That's basically what Gutenberg came up with. He had a couple extra innovations for sure that are definitely credited to him directly. But that general idea had been around for a couple hundred years at least before he started printing his own stuff using this machine of his invention. Now, again, this is not detracted at all from Gutenberg. He put together a lot of disparate ideas, and there's also a lot of debate whether he would have known about the Korean or Chinese advancements in printing. If so, maybe it was the Mongols that spread it west, but they're not entirely certain. There's no smoking gun. So it's possible he also thought of it himself just by being involved in it and thinking about it. Or maybe he heard about some other stuff and refined it into his own thing. Regardless, he came up with the printing press, and the Chinese and the Koreans are not credited with that for actually a couple of reasons. And the upshot of all of it is that it didn't ever really take off in China or Korea. Even though it was invented there, it didn't become widespread or widely used, and it certainly didn't create an information age revolution.
Well, how's this for a cliffhanger? We'll take a little break, and we'll tell you a couple more reasons why it never took off in Asia right after this.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today. All right, Chuck, I can't take this any longer. Tell us why it never took off in Asia.
Well, some reasons that just make a lot of sense. They have very complex characters with their language, and they have, you know, up to tens of thousands of characters with different pronunciations, different phonemes, different syllables. And you just can't do it. You can't have that many little tiny blocks, much less multiples of those if you want to print a page.
Right.
You know, because it's not like you can move them around. And then keeping up with all these was literally one of the big problems. Like, they made these big, I think there was a man named Wang Zhen, who use these revolving tables to access these big racks of letters. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of like what you were talking about with the house made of wood blocks,
exactly,
of 130,000 woodcuts.
Right.
It's like you just can't keep up with that many. So it wasn't practical. And then Gutenberg comes along. He's like, we only have 26 letters.
Yeah.
So this is pretty dumbed down as a language goes.
Yeah, because, I mean, even if you do, you know, capitals and lowercase, that's still just, what, 52?
Yeah, throw in some punctuation.
Yeah, some punctuation, make some doubles, because, you know, you're going to use E a lot more times than one per page. So you need to make some backup copies of them.
How many did he? He made about 300 in the end, right?
That's what I saw, yeah. 300 different character spaces, punctuation, uppercase, lowercase. And that's all he needed. So
yeah.
300 versus tens of thousands. Number one, it's just easier to make, but number two, it's easier to keep up with, too. So Gutenberg just happened to be working in just the right language for a movable type printing press to really make sense.
Should we talk about this guy?
Yeah, because I like him. He had a bit of a hustle to him, and I like
that. I know. And he's also one of history's kind of hard luck guys in a way, even though, I mean, you know, his name is legendary, so you can't put a price on that. I'm sure he would have liked to have put a price on that.
So I just want to say, from what I saw, it is very much up for debate whether he actually was financially ruined in the end
or
if he was doing fine. Because one thing we got to tell everybody, Chuck, out of the gate is Gutenberg was born at a time where his father was a patrician. He was an aristocrat in Germany, Mainz, Germany. So he was, you know, notable, but this wasn't a time where people of that class, you know, he wasn't like a king or anything like that. So there was not a lot of documentation of his birth. We're not entirely certain when he was born. His early life is kind of lost to history, too, because he was just kind of a nobody until he invented the printing press. But the thing is, when he invented the printing press, it was so revolutionary and so obvious how revolutionary it was out of the gate that within a decade or two of his death, historians were studying and documenting his life. So there is a surprising amount of stuff that was documented about him that's preserved still, but the stuff that we do have is almost entirely his work and then court records when he was dragged into court by creditors and investors.
Yeah, so you said he had a little bit of a hustle. I think Ed says they referred to him charitably as having entrepreneurial flair. That's another word of saying he had a bit of a hustle to him, and he would get in. He was always trying to make a buck, always had some sort of scheme in the works, and which means he had investors a lot of times, and a lot of times he might not come through. So as a result, he was taken to court a lot, like you said, and it's kind of funny to build this guy's life out of court records. But we are able to construct a little bit of it because of him being hauled in there and being sued time and time again.
And most notably, we're able to kind of piece together the printing press that he invented, what he knew when from these court records, because all of these lawsuits basically were over his work. They were between investors in his work and him. And the thing is like, I don't have the impression that he was a hustler in the sense that he was a con man or a shark or anything like that.
So.
He had very high aspirations. He also had the smarts to figure out how to achieve these aspirations. He just didn't have the money to achieve these aspirations, so he needed outside help. His big problem, as far as investors go, from what I can tell, is that he was a perfectionist. So rather than just figure out how to invent the movable type printing press, which he did, he also tried to figure out one that could also print in red on a different set, or using copper engraving to create different types of type. Some stuff that, like, details that were, like, kind of unnecessary, but made this transform this thing from, you know, an amazing piece of work to a masterpiece. And the time it took to be that much of a perfectionist made him run into creditors and investors that were not that patient.
Yeah. And his first sort of tinkering with pressing anything, it seems, because of, again, a lawsuit, was in Strasbourg when he lived there in around 1438. Is that CE? And he would he had this plan to produce these trinkets for people going on religious pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Is.
Right.
More
right.
than one.
Yeah.
So he had these tools that he could stamp out these trinkets and press these things. And so he sort of had an idea, at least, of how this kind of technology worked as far as cutting something, stamping, and pressing it.
And there's some indication, Chuck, that he was already figuring out the rough contours, if not more detail than that, of his printing press in Strasbourg, because that first court case was by the family of some creditors who took him to court because they wanted in on some secret work he was keeping from them. and being investors in him, they were saying, well, you know, if you're doing work on the side, we should have a piece of that too. And that's where some historians are like, this actually what they're describing here is part of the printing press.
Yeah, because
it's up for debate still, though.
Well, I mean, it was 10 years later. That was in around 1438. And by the time he got back to Mainz in 1448, he borrowed some money from his cousin to do like a real printing business. So it's, I think you could be right. It's very likely those people knew that he was in the back room with his plan to print books.
Right.
And they wanted some of that action.
Right, but he's like, no, dude, you invested on the ground floor of the trinket business. This is a whole different world-changing business. You're going to have to cough up some more dough. And they said, nine.
Yeah, they did say nine. And he said, all right, well, I'm going to invent this thing, or I'm going to cobble together a bunch of other people's work in a way that makes sense, that you can, you know, make massive amounts of books right. that look good and that you can sell and make money on. And the Bible was a pretty obvious choice for the first big, big project. Mm-hmm. But he was like, the Bible is a lot to undertake. And if you've ever seen a Gutenberg Bible, they're huge. They're not
there's two volumes.
Yeah, there's not like these little handheld Bibles. They're very large. And I didn't get an exact measurement, but you can see when someone holds it. It's a big, big book. It's like a fat coffee table book.
Let's say 11 by 18.
Mm, they seem a little wider than that, but—
36 by 99. That's as high as I'm going.
So he said, $1. He said that I'm gonna not start with the Bible. Too much to bite off.
Yeah.
It's a little dull. So I'm going to start out with some other stuff. I'm going to print some pamphlets. I'm going to see if I can sell these things. I'm going to see how good they look. And he did. He printed a grammar book, was one of the first things. This is from another lawsuit by a Roman writer. And it was a popular book, which was, again, it's a smart thing that he did, is basically taking like what would be a bestseller at the time and seeing if he could mass produce it instead of block book as a regular printed book.
Right. So he was also doing broadsheets, which are kind of like early newspapers, which they had a pretty – we should do one on newspapers, because the early life of newspapers were these broadsheets, and sailors would buy them, read them, and then take them into town at the next port, and they would be sold to those people who most people weren't literate at the time. So they would hire somebody who could read in town to read the news out at like the local tavern or something.
And we both have experience with newspapers.
Sure, man. I would like to do newspapers one day. Let's do it.
I would totally. That sounds like a two-parter to me.
Okay. So he basically, the upshot of all this, and I think that's the second time I've said that. I never say that. I always want to like deliberately make everything much slower than that. The upshot of something like
you say
summarizes
upshot all the time.
It. Do I?
Yeah. Just like you say it as much as we talk about Gutenberg and Party Down.
You know what's sad? I'm an unreliable narrator in my own life.
Oh, man. What a great quote.
So the overall general point of what we've been saying up to this moment is that he kind of broke his teeth on some slightly easier projects to kind of figure out the ins and outs and everything. And then when he was finally ready to do the Bible, he apparently was well aware that this was going to be a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah.
He had figured it out, and he was ready to bite it off, and he started work on the Gutenberg Bible, also known as the Gutenberg Bible, and also known as the 42-line Bible, because that's how many lines he had per page.
Okay.
And even at 42 lines per page, which was more lines, because he lowered the space in between lines to fit more lines per page, it was still something like 1,286 pages.
Yeah.
Over two volumes. That's a lot. But the kind of, bear that in mind. What we're talking about when we talk about this project eventually is that he was creating 1,286 page Bibles, okay?
Yeah. One at a time.
Yeah.
One page at a time, that is. So, which we'll figure in here in a second. So he starts to work. He knows that, before he starts, he knows that he's going to be able to charge a lot for these things. And he knows he's going to need to crank them out as quickly as he can. So he's going to need more space. He's going to need more presses. He's going to need a lot of ink and other little doodads and spondivets that it takes to make one of these. And he's going to need people. You know, he's going to need some assistance. He can't do it all by himself because here's where that comes back. You can only – it's not like he would print out a Bible and he's like, I got one. Go sell this thing and we can continue to fund our little project here. You got to print out one page at a time over and over and over and over, and then print out page two over and over and over, or two and whatever the reverse side is. And eventually you're going to be able to start putting them together in bound form, and only then can you start actually making money.
Right. So he was also, that was another thing that he doesn't get credited for enough, I think, is that he figured out like how to do a rough, primitive version of an assembly line, basically.
That sure.
He was mass producing these books out of the gate. That was the point. You're mass producing it, not doing it one page at a time, like you were saying, like the old block books used to be.
Right. So he gets four presses going at a time. Later went up to, I think, six. Mm-hmm. And because of all this upfront money that he needs to keep this going until he can sell them mm-hmm. and turn a profit was he needed, like always, he needed some dough. He didn't have his pockets lined with money. So he had to go to a guy, and this guy's name was Johann Fust.
Mm-hmm. Because he had calculated he would need about 2 years, and because—
Before he could start selling?
Yeah, the whole project he figured out was going to be about 2 years. This print run of Bibles is going to take him 2 years to do, so he needed to be able to pay everybody. He needed money for all the supplies, all the materials. He needed to be able to survive for 2 years because he would not be able to sell one single Bible until all of them were done. None of them were going to be done until all of them were done. That's just the way the process worked out.
Right. So Fust, I think, saw the writing on the wall, knew it was going to be expensive, but mm-hmm. knew that he was going to probably be able to make a lot of money. And who knows? I don't know this Fust guy from Adam, but maybe in the back of his head, he also thought, you know what? I might also be able to just sue this guy at some point and take control of these printing presses because this guy didn't have a pot to urinate in and he's not going to have any money. So, and that's exactly what happened. He ended up having no assets other than these presses. And when he got sued and lost, and I don't even know what he got sued for. Was it for taking too long?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, that makes the whole thing that much worse, that he was sued basically, like I was saying, for being a perfectionist.
Wow.
And technically, Gutenberg could have gotten the Bible out before Fust sued him. Just a slightly less masterful version
right.
that would have just knocked everyone's socks
sure.
off, had just the same amount of an impact on the world. Mm-hmm. I don't think the world would have been changed really any had he gotten them out in a time when Fust was willing to not sue him. But he wasn't prepared to do that. He was an artist. He was an artiste. He had the soul of an artiste. So he just kept going deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole to try to make this thing more and more perfect and elaborate. And Fust said enough. And the court actually sided with Fust. So Fust lent him 800 gulden, or golden, which at the time was about the price of—
It's a lot of money.
Eight houses.
Yeah.
That's what we're going with. We'll see in a second. It'll make sense. But let's say eight average cost houses. That's how much he lent him. Then he did it again. He lent him another 800 golden. And so he was into him for 1,600 golden. Would have easily been able to pay that back. When Fust sued him, the court said, not only do you owe him 1,600 golden, you owe him in interest, we're going to say, too. Get this. About 2,020 golden is what he ended up having to pay Fust.
Now, did he sue him because he was that far over schedule?
The only thing—
Because he told him it would take 2 years. Did it take right. like six or something?
I saw that from the court records, they believe that he was done by 1455. And I believe he started in 1453, so he was probably right on schedule. I have the impression that Fust was a bit of an impatient jerkwad.
Well, and also get the feeling that that Gutenberg probably didn't dot his I's and cross his T's contractually.
Maybe not. Maybe not. I could see that, too.
Because you got to bake in a little bit of overtime there, you know?
For sure. But I think he may have been roughly on schedule. Because by 1452, he had created the Bible. And here's the other thing. Here's the other reason why Fust suing him was a bit of a screw job, or a huge screw job. And by screw job, I mean like the act of a screwdriver screwing a screw into a slab of wood that the screw doesn't want to go into that wood. It wants uh-huh. to stay free.
Exactly.
Like that kind of thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, kids.
So the reason why it really stunk that Fust sued him is because he got the Bibles done. The Bible run was completed, and Fust still sued him and still won. If I had been Fust and the investor, I would have been like, okay, fine, you finished. Maybe pay me more or something like that, but that was not the case.
Yeah, and who knows what's going on back then. He could have bribed a judge who got a piece of the action, you know?
Right, exactly.
I mean, that's speculation, but I'm just saying it's not like today when our court system is just so perfect in every way.
Right. Flawless, run exclusively by artificial intelligence.
So Ed was kind enough to cobble together a few just sort of fun facts about that Bible run. Mm-hmm. He printed 180 of these things initially, sold all of them, of course. Mm-hmm. Today, there are 49 of them still around, which Ed points out, and I agree, is a really great survival percentage for something that old.
Yeah.
49 out of 180, and that just sort of pinpoints or just puts a point in the fact that puts a pin in? What am I trying to say? Really drives home
sure, the
fact that these things were very cherished and taken care of from the beginning. I went to see how much you could buy one of these for.
Oh, yeah. What'd you find?
Well, 87 was the last one I saw at auction. There may be one since then. But in 1987, it went for $5.4 million.
So that was one volume. A complete set hasn't been auctioned since 1978.
Oh,
and that
really?
Went for $2.2 million in 1978 dollars.
Wow.
From what I saw, if you were going
to— So you get half a Bible, you get the New Old Testament only or something?
If you're lucky. But if the complete copy, they think would be $35 million today.
If it
went to auction,
that makes sense. That's about right.
But so he made two. He made two versions. He made one like a regular version on paper, and it sold for 20 golden. And he made a vellum one on calfskin for 50 golden.
Yeah.
He made 45 of those. So allow me to figure these calculations real quick, okay?
Oh, boy. Here we go. Math.
So remember.
Math time with Josh.
I'm going to get this right,
Chuck.
All
right. Uh-huh.
So there's this historian named Andrew Pettigrew who says that a house in Mainz, would have cost up to 100 golden, a house. So the total that he could have made selling these Bibles, this 180 print run of Bibles, is 4,950 golden.
That's a lot of houses.
It is. Let's say at 100 golden a piece, that's 49 and a half houses. Don't ask about the half of a house. But let's say in today's dollars that we're saying that a house is $200,000 per house.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
So $200,000 times 49 and a half houses means that he made off of these 180 Bibles almost $10 million.
Oh, I can't wait for the correction.
It's right, dude. I am definitely right. And so here's the other thing too. So when Fust sues him and gets that judgment of 2,000 golden against him, a lot of people say, well, that ruined Gutenberg and he died a pauper. If that Bible run sold out, he still would have had more than half of that nearly $10 million yeah. left over after paying Fust. So it's very much unclear that he was a pauper or not. The overall point of what I've been saying up to this moment is this.
The upshot?
It's that that was the word you could have used earlier, too. When you were looking for a word, uh-huh. upshot would have worked.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
I wasn't going to encourage the use of that, though. But the upshot of it is that Fust got his hands on Gutenberg's printing press
right
after that run of Bibles was made.
Or his six printing presses, rather.
Yeah. And his printing assistant, who was actually Fust's son-in-law, he got the whole shebang, all of his plates, everything.
You know what my favorite thing about your math stuff is?
What?
I know the second that you start that there are thousands of people, math busters, if you will,
okay.
that just immediately get out their pencil and pad and
awesome.
To see if they can prove you wrong.
That is fantastic.
It's like a game.
I'm fine with that. Yeah, it is a game, and I always win.
All right, so we're going to take another break.
Okay.
We're going to tally up your math wins and losses.
All right.
And we're going to talk about how this thing actually worked right after this.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Hey, everyone. Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
So I think we came up, Chuck, with the that I've won every math contest
I've initiated. Every one.
Okay.
All right. So shall we talk about the Gutenberg Press?
Yes.
Well, you got your individual letters.
Okay. All right. So
if you're going to – we said he ended up making 300 of these things. So you're going to need all these little individual letters carved. Mm-hmm. They're carved into steel. Using these little files, and these are the master letters, and then they punch those into soft metal, most likely copper, and then the impression in the copper is formed into a mold, and then you're going to pour molten metal. And what I saw was that one thing that Gutenberg definitely invented was this hand casting instrument, where they actually where you would actually pour this molten metal. I think you use lead, tin, and antimony. Whatever that is.
That was an alloy that he invented even. Like, add that to his list.
Yeah, so he invented some stuff, but this is how you would actually make the individual letters was by this early process.
Right. So the one thing that's still up for debate supposedly is whether he invented or used that punch matrix thing where you punch the letter into a softer metal. They're not entirely certain. But yes, he definitely was casting letters with alloy of his own making. And apparently it cooled like the moment, like you just poured it in, closed the mold and opened it, and it would be cool enough to dump out on the table and start filing down. Because that was the other thing, too. You had to file down every letter to make sure that they were uniform.
Yeah.
And he even went, this is an example of how detailed he got. He even was like, oh, well, this F has a lot of space between, you know, on either side of it. So he filed down the sides of all the Fs after testing it a few times to make basically kerning. He figured out kerning right out of the gate. The first time anyone had ever really created the printing press, there was also kerning.
Which is awesome.
Which is the spacing between letters. Like if you've ever seen a bunch of letters strung far apart. It looks really weird.
Yeah.
Kerning
not a
is,
fan of that.
That's a high kerning value. Low kerning value is where they're tighter together, which is what you want.
Yeah. So the long and short of his of these little blocks, though, is that you only needed to carve each one time. Mm-hmm. You had to pour a bunch of molds if you wanted a bunch of E's or A's right. or other vowels and stuff.
But that was nothing.
But yeah, that was nothing. You only had to do that carving once. File these things down until they're all uniform. And then it moves on to someone known as the compositor.
Yes, the compositor, not to be confused with the eradicator.
Right.
From Kids in the Hall. The compositor was the person who sat there with, like, the manuscript, right, and read each line. And as they were reading each line, they were gathering the letters they needed and putting the letters together in, like a handheld little rack to basically make each line. And they would slide each line into a frame called the form. And you would do that just line by line until the whole form, the whole frame is filled up with the lines that you're going to print a page with.
Yeah, basically what they did in Korea 200 years earlier.
Except with far fewer characters.
Yeah, and you get the idea that if you were a compositor working for Gutenberg, the perfectionist, mm-hmm. it was probably a pretty nervy job because you're reading that manuscript. Any misspelling, any misuse of punctuation, I'm sure there would have been hecht pay from Herr Gutenberg. So mm-hmm. I imagine that job was just sort of high tension.
And Gutenberg very famously was super passive aggressive in his managerial style.
Was
he? He would just kind of wander around the shop with his coffee and say,
oh, you're going to print it that way, huh?
I'm going to need you to work Sunday as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And nice. it was like you'd try to avoid him or whatever, but he had this sixth sense to like pop up exactly right as you were trying to leave for the day.
Right. And he would ask about your stapler. Mm-hmm. And he would say, this is my red stapler that I always keep at my desk. That was
one of the press men.
Right, of course.
They just kind of kept in the basement. It was a weird time for printing.
It was. Another weird time is going to be right now when I ask you if you understand this gobbledygook about folios.
Yeah, so what they figured out
Because it's a little confusing
was,
to me.
Right, so it's way easier to print. Yes, a logistical nightmare is another way to put it.
Yeah.
But if you take, one large page that's actually two pages of a book wide and fold it, you have a folio.
Sure.
And supposedly Gutenberg printed these things in folios of five so that each little, I guess, thing that they did was like 20 pages. They would do 20 pages at a time. For remember, something like 1,286 pages they were doing this mm-hmm. total per Bible. And I mean, that was that. The key was this. No, to answer your question, I didn't fully understand the folios. I think there was a lot made of folios when there didn't necessarily need to be a lot made of folios. The point was that when you printed this stuff, this was very, very tricky. You had to dampen the paper.
Oh, okay.
Because if you didn't, did you like that? We're yeah. leaping ahead.
Just kind of breeze right on by that.
Yeah. When you print on paper using the kind of ink that he created, another thing he created, which we'll talk about, the paper can stick very easily unless you dampen the paper. The problem is you got to print on the backside too, but you can't dampen the paper again, my friend, or else you're going to smear the ink on the other side or it's going to run or whatever. So they would dampen the paper, print one side, and then have to print the other side like after the ink on the one side was dry, but before the paper had dried fully.
Right.
Which is, that's got to be tricky. You talk about nerviness and high stress. I mean, especially when you're on like if it's 180 Bibles in a $10 million project, I mean, each page is rather expensive and valuable. So you don't want to screw up any of them, you know?
So if you want to look at a press, again, I would go to YouTube and see the video of it actually being done. But the press has two sections. You've got this frame that allows the plates and the paper to align themselves, mm-hmm. The carriage, and then the actual press part of the press. Mm-hmm. And you set these plates onto the carriage and they're facing up. And then you apply ink using these, and when you see it on the video, it kind of looks like kind of looks like these big giant gourds. They have a handle and then this big round sort of drum head looking body.
Right.
And you stamp, you know, you roll this thing all around in the ink and then roll them around on each other to make sure that all the ink is really, really even. And it's actually goose skin, these pads are. And then you just go around and stamp these four plates. And, you know, from the looks of the way this guy did it, it took about maybe a minute and a half to fully ink them for a good page. Mm-hmm. And these things look kind of heavy, you know. He doesn't roll them because if you roll them, you end up smearing.
Okay.
So he's just sort of pounding them on there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of work. And all of this looks like a lot of work. Even the pressing part is takes like, you know, a lot of manual strength.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, 2 years to just print 180 Bibles.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a physical workout.
Right.
He uses this ink you mentioned. It's an oil-based varnish. Previously, for many, many hundreds of years, they used water-based, mm-hmm. which is just no good. Water-based ink is not what you want to do when you're printing a book.
No, and that was actually another reason why it didn't catch on, printing didn't catch on in China and Korea, too, is they were using water-based inks exclusively, and it runs, it smears, it doesn't stay in place, it's just a bad jam. And that was another innovation of Gutenberg's, which was to use oil-based ink. There was somebody, I can't remember, we've talked about it in a podcast before, but they were talking about how some inventor just knocked something out of the park his first time out. And they said that it was akin to had the Wright brothers invented their airplane complete with airline miles and food trays that came down off the back of the seat in front of you. It was just like this complete thing. And that's kind of what Gutenberg did with the printing press. He solved all the problems all at once in his initial invention. Like, he figured it all out. And as we'll see, it stayed the same for hundreds of years as a result.
Yeah, so to hold the paper in place, because, you know, this frame is upright, and then you end up folding it down, it's mm-hmm. held in by these pins. These look like little nail heads sticking, or not nail heads, but nail pointy parts.
Yeah.
The opposite of the head.
The ouchy part.
And that way, when you flip it over, because you're going to have to print that other side, it's exactly in the same spot that it was before.
Mm-hmm.
Another nice little, very rudimentary way of making something perfect.
Right.
And then you mentioned earlier he made certain parts red, this rubrication.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what they did for the Gutenberg Bible, but in the King James Version, if I'm not mistaken, Jesus's words are all in red.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
I think I remember it, that being the case. But I think he just used it here for certain parts and maybe flourishes of art. And there was some hand-drawn art and stuff like that as well.
Well, yeah, they went to hand-drawn because he had so much trouble with the red, like going back and printing after the black was printed, printing on the same page with just the red text.
It's pretty advanced stuff back then.
Right, but they said, yeah, we'll just go do the hand lettering like traditionally is done. Nobody will be mad at us for it.
Right, like what do you call it when the first letter is big?
Drop cap.
Yeah, drop cap.
They did those in red for sure.
Yeah, and then you've got your screw. The screw press he used, he kind of ganked from wine and grape presses. And, you know, once you have this thing inked up, you move it over to the press, and it's just a big, big armed lever. It's not like something that moves in a circle.
Right.
You just kind of pull it really tough, kind of one or maybe two times, and then boom, you've got your printed page.
You do, and Ed points out something that I think is overlooked, but, you know, and one of the other problems with Chinese and Korean printing or any kind of printing using, like, wood blocks or something like that is you're going to get uneven pressure, so you're going to get an uneven transfer of ink. One of the genius things about the press, about it using basically a wine press for printing, is that it applies even slow pressure at, you know, increasing pressure and then decreasing pressure as you unscrew the screw. So
at the same rate, like over the whole plate.
Right. So there was a nice even amount of pressure that was increasingly introduced and decreasingly reduced, that really kind of made this beautiful outcome for the printed page.
Yeah, you get when this guy in this video holds up the little printed page at the end there, you know, there's a little moment of ooh and ah going on in that room.
Right. And like a little trickle of blood comes out of his ear as he's just gazing into the camera.
Oh, man. I was worried about that guy for a minute.
I got to go see that.
Yeah, you should check him out.
So That's the printing press. We should say after Gutenberg printed those Bibles, Fuchs got his hands on those presses almost immediately, and in very short order, I think like less than 2 years, released a Psalter, which is also considered a masterpiece. But Fuchs put his name on it, even though Gutenberg had basically created the whole thing. He also made a business for himself creating these Bibles using Gutenberg's old plates because he got his hands on all those through the court.
Fuchs.
But again, Gutenberg was certainly not lost to history. Everybody knew what he did and very quickly, you know, revered him as a hero extraordinaire. But we were talking about what the Gutenberg press did for the world. And it's really tough to overstate the impact that it had on things.
Yeah, I mean, just think about, like you said, the first information age, getting out information on government and politics and democracy. And I mean, just little things like how-tos and, you know, there might have been a how-to on how to make those nails that we talked about in the blacksmithing episode.
Right.
Although I think a lot of that is passed down. But all of a sudden you can get this out en masse and— And that's the whole thing. It's like all of a sudden hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people could read information.
Right. And they could learn to read, too, because books were now way more affordable than they had been before. And actually, ironically enough, I ran across a History.com article called 7 Ways the Printing Press Changed the World by our own Dave Ruse.
Oh,
and
nice.
He points out this, and I thought this was really important. With the printing press, it made it way easier to make way more copies of something than ever before, which also made it harder to stamp out new ideas. Whereas before, if you had some heretic who had this new idea about, you know, the earth revolving around the sun rather than the other way around,
yeah,
all you had to do was kill that person, burn them at the stake, and then burn their copies of their notes along with them, and idea gone, right?
Yeah.
Now, that person could make a bunch of copies and disseminate them, and so this idea would be out there. You could kill that person, but their idea was going to survive because there were too many copies for you to get your hands on and stamp out. And that led to things like the Enlightenment, like the revolution in America and in France, and the birth of democracy in the West. Like all of this stuff came from that ability to disseminate things like never before.
In the legal system, it allowed judges to throw the book at people?
Yeah, before it was
they
just
had one book. Yeah, they wouldn't throw that one thing.
No,
they
could
might
really
not get it back.
Somebody. That's right. So, wow, that was a good one. I think on that one, we should end this episode on the Gutenberg printing press, don't you?
Yes.
Well, since I said don't you, everybody, it's time for listener mail.
All right, I'm going to call this sweepstakes winner.
Nice.
This is from Devin Johns. Hey, guys, just listened to the sweepstakes podcast. Wanted to share one of my wins as a sweeper. In 2016, I saw a sweepstakes from Interstate Battery and Firestone, where they were giving away 2 trucks and a bunch of gift cards. All you had to do was get a free battery check at any Firestone and enter with your invoice.
Wow.
I thought, I need an oil change, so I might as well get that battery checked and enter. Less than 3 months later, I was contacted by a third-party company who facilitates the sweepstakes. Didn't answer.
They told me I didn't win.
And he won a gift card. No, he won a truck. He won one of those 2 trucks. 2017 Chevy Silverado.
Wow.
He said, I loved having the truck, but as you guys said, you got to pay taxes on winnings, which counts as income, so I ended up selling it, buying a nice used car, and paying off debt. I've won a bunch of stuff and have learned how to spot real and fake giveaways, but they do exist, so keep entering. And that is Devin Johns.
And he included a picture of himself with his Le Car.
Yeah.
It's great. It looks good still.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Devin. Congratulations. And that is a fantastic story. That's a perfect listener mail response to the sweepstakes episode, if you ask me.
Yeah, and a smart, responsible thing you did by getting a cheaper thing and then paying off debt. Good for you.
Yeah. Well, if you want us to give you a pat on the head for something you did, email to us. You can send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line. thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.